Yo, this is Rob Harvilla from 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, the world's greatest loopy and perverse and inaccurately named music nostalgia podcast. We're doing 90 songs now because there's too many songs. Pearl Jam, Jay-Z, Jewel, U2, Cher, Hootie. These are just some of the names people yell at me on the internet because we're back. More great songs, more rad special guests, more loopy perversity. Join us once more on 60 Songs That Explain the 90s every Wednesday on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, I think of him constantly. It's Andy Greenwald!
That had a real Us vibe at the end of this episode of Andor, didn't it?
Yeah, the question is, who's Lonnie and who's Luthen? Andy, what a special show we have today. As promised, Tony Gilroy makes his second appearance on The Watch podcast to discuss everything that's happened on Andor up through episode 10. So spoiler warning, ahoy, if you have not listened, we're going to try and get this up early. So as soon as you guys get a chance to listen or watch Andor, rather, the 10th episode, you can just dive right in with your two best galactic buddies, you know, the sort of tour guides of the Lucasfilm universe. Andy, what's going on with you?
Is that us? You're talking about us? Are we the tour guides?
You and me. Yeah.
That's great. You're Lando, and I'm the guy with many cheeks. Just sitting next to Lando.
That's right.
Stressing out. Things are good. You know, I was just reading about how Maddie
BT
Healy...
Dubs, we're recording this on Tuesday at 2 p.m.
So everything's fine.
That's why you hear this note of optimism in our voices.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I've gone full Cameron and Daphne, White Lotus season 2.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, why would I read the news? It just bums me out kind of thing.
Yeah, everything's good. Yeah. And I'm very optimistic. Chris, I was just reading about how Maddie Healy from the band The 1975 was on stage at Madison Square Garden last night, pretending to masturbate and eating a raw steak. And then I was reading that his mother, who I did not know, is a famous actress on Coronation Street in the UK, was in the crowd. And so someone was like, don't take your parents to the show, with footage of Maddie Healy grabbing his crotch. And she was like, imagine if you are the mom. Nauseous emoji, nauseous emoji, nauseous emoji. And all of this is just background to say, like, I think of the many weird things that have happened this year, pre-midterms, you know, because I think it's going to get super weird starting tomorrow. Me suddenly loving The 1975, that's big up there for me in my personal Rolodex of surprises.
You know what the thing with you is?
Yeah.
You've now like limited the amount of culture that you interface with that you can have like real big swings of emotions. And I love you for it. You know, like, it's like if you only watch 5 shows, 2 of them are going to be great.
First of all, as a critic for many years, I can attest that is not true. That is not true. I would say, honestly, like great TV shows. I mean, baseball players have better, you know, like if you fail 7 times, you're a superstar. I think that's easier than TV. But no, I don't feel that's the case with the music. I listen to music. We just don't do much music on this podcast anymore.
You know, so, it doesn't do numbers. And this is a sort of data-driven podcast, if anybody knows, like my kind of approach that's really moneyballing it. I'm looking for the inefficiencies wherever I can find it. And that's why we hammer the shows that are important, like Andor.
I'm pretty surprised that, you know, now that we are part of the larger Spotify, is it a community? It's Scandinavian, so I feel like it's a collective. that we aren't more data driven. Do you know what I mean? Like, or do you protect me from that? Because guys, you should know this. Like, I feel like if there is critical rain drumming down on the rooftop of this podcast, Chris is the Chris keeps us dry.
I like to put my playmakers in a position to make plays. Like, I don't want that cloud in your head. I don't want that nagging at you.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Your 1975 affection is great. I think I too was late coming to the band, but you know, I just super appreciate what they do. And I think that if I was younger, I'd be right there watching that guy masturbate and eat steak.
You are younger. Come on. It's not your birthday till next week.
Andy, should we jump into this 10th episode of Andor?
Yeah.
This is the best show on TV.
Yeah.
Like a pretty far margin.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing about this show now is that it's not that it would be considered predictable, because I really don't know where this thing is going, even though we ultimately know where this thing is going, especially for Cassian. There's a sensation that I get. I need the German word for this.
Okay.
Of when you're watching something and you know what you're about to get is the thing that you have been expecting.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow the thing exceeds your wildest dreams of what your expectations could be. So you're watching this. This is not, for as brilliant as this show is, it's not reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, like he's going to get out of prison. That'll be cool. And it's way cooler than I could have possibly imagined. And I'm like, at some point, Luthen's going to have a big monologue, because that's what spies do, is eventually they have to fucking break it all down and tell you who they are and what they're all about. And I'm like, oh, Luthen's going to have a big speech now. They got Stellan blocked on this bridge. He's wearing a cape. Kind of looks like Darth Vader. Don't know what that's about. And I'm like, it's going to happen now. We're going to get it. And I'm like, that's the best fucking speech I ever heard. You know, like, I'm like, just like, it's like that in the Gettysburg Address. I don't know what to say.
Chris,
the show keeps doing it. What is that feeling when you're like, oh, I knew this was coming and it's so much better than I could have anticipated?
It's called pleasure. We don't seek it. We don't talk about it. We don't consider its role in our entertainment nearly enough. And we mistake again and again. And I feel like we've said versions of this before when we've been raving about things. We overrate surprise. We overrate innovation. We overrate disruption. There is something to be said for the shock of the new, and some of our favorite shows of the last few years, whether it's I May Destroy You or Atlanta and Fleabag, which you were, you know, I think correctly name-checking last week in terms of when things started to pivot in this television moment. There is something about them that is both good for us as viewers in the moment and good for the industry writ large. It's laying down a marker that this could be something else, and that's wonderful. But we like to, it's not just TV. Like you could repurpose this argument and make it about food. You know, mm-hmm. You can make it about interactions with friends or nights out or romance. Like surprise is overrated. We have a sense of where things are going or where they might end up. We don't know how we're going to get there. And that's where the magic is in being excited that we're going to go on a ride. We know where the ride ends, but we don't know the exact pace of the journey or what we're going to see along the way. And so you're right. This season is a masterclass in that, because in these three episode arcs, we because we like culture and we've watched many things and read books, we know where this is going. We knew that when they were on Aldani, that there would be a giant set piece, that something would go wrong, that not everyone would survive. We knew Cassian would, but beyond that, we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in no way less pleasurable because of that. In fact, it was more pleasurable because we were on the tips of our toes or edges of our seat being like, okay, how is this going to go? And so same thing, you put them on a prison planet with, 5,000 men?
Who knows? They don't know. They can't figure it. It's like, how many levels are there to that place? Yeah.
They don't know. And, you know, little things. We keep checking the small details and praising Luke Hull, the production designer, for the details, and Tony Gilroy and his other writers and collaborators for all the details. But like when Cassian arrived on the planet, we noticed the ocean. We noticed the churning, I don't know what those are called, combines, whatever those are. They mattered. It all mattered. We knew there was going to be a prison break, but we didn't know what it was going to look like. And it's so fucking fun. It's so fun to know that whoever the person who's driving the bus is a master.
You know what you're talking about? You're talking about the way we feel about the show in general. Like I'm talking about these specific moments, but I think the reason why we've been overwhelmed by this thing is it's like when you read great poetry or great literature and you realize that it's articulating something that you've never felt but had the words for. Or you've always felt but you've never had the words for. Mm-hmm. And not to compare like, you know, Andor to like a Wallace Stevens poem or something, but like you are like, I've always kind of wondered what it would feel like if this took itself very seriously and talked about like what would happen if a bunch of people decided they had had enough of the empire, but they weren't wizards, you know? Mm-hmm. What would happen if, how do you raise money? How do you radicalize people? How do you get them to become true believers? How do you get people to give up their lives? How do you, what kind of sacrifices would have to be made across the board? And we're starting to see that. And so like watching the show, I'm never like, oh my God, I can't believe the multiverse twist here. You're just like, oh yeah, like this is on another level than I knew was possible for this.
Yeah. And let's talk about, this comes up briefly, I think, in our conversation with Tony, but and I don't even think it's a straw Wookiee argument, but like the idea that one of the problems with the show is that there aren't a lot of aliens. Well, like, look, step aside from that for a second. This show has put humanity back into Star Wars. Remember, it's not just the aliens or the Hutts or the whatever. We're talking about the Mandalorians with their masks that have dominated the mythos for all this time. We're talking about a movie series that, when it talks about human emotion, talks about how it's bad. That fear leads to hate and hate leads to suffering and suffering leads to the dark side. And these things need to be clamped down on and buried deep and turned into magic powers that will allow you to defeat your father, defeat your evil. That aspect of Jediism and religion is, you know, it's honestly fascinating when there's space to poke at it, but we haven't really poked at it. We've just sort of folded it into the superhero myth, which is to say that like, it's better to be Superman than Clark Kent. So let's go for that.
Right.
This episode, I mean, all of them have been broadly about that in the most wonderful way possible, but Mon Mothma's fear and disgust about the choices that are laying in front of her, which we should circle back to because that scene was amazing. But specifically thinking about Andy Serkis's arc, which we do talk to Tony about, but like we are living with this guy for three episodes and we understand what motivates him. We understand why he is the way he is. And it's due to a great performance, but also great writing. And the decision that he makes to rebel, how he rebels, what it means for him to rebel, all to build to a moment where he has made something of his life, at least to us, the audience, and to those who followed him, and he can't swim. You know, he can't swim.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful moment, and that's all of it right there. You know what I mean? Like, they were all afraid.
He didn't have a political epiphany either. This is the best thing about it. It's like, there's no political epiphany on Kino's part. He doesn't all of a sudden start looking at Nemec's notebook and start thinking in terms of like overthrowing power structures. He's like, I'm out of options. I had a pretty good life here, as good as it could have possibly been. I'm the shot caller in this prison and my number's going down. But then he finds out that it doesn't matter if your number goes down to zero because you're just going to get transferred to another bridge, basically. And he is like, okay, if you remove all these other options, and then that ties in to the Luthen speech, because Luthen is essentially talking about sacrificing 50 men just for Lonnie, you know, and it's cold and it's calculating and it's cynical, but it also gets Lonnie to start thinking, what's this? If this guy is willing to do this for me, he's willing to do anything for his ultimate goal. And I'm sure one of the reasons why Luthen is as candid as he is with Lonnie in that last scene between the two of them is because he doesn't really think he'll ever see this guy again, nor will he see him again. Because I just have a feeling like there's one way out here, as they say in that prison. There's not going to be a reunion of the rebels talking about like what great moves they made. This is cutthroat zero sum stuff. And I just thought that those two scenes kind of spoke to probably Tony's vision of what does it really take to stage a rebellion? Well, it takes eliminating everybody else's other options, because who would want to be part of a rebellion? Who would want to do that?
Yeah, and I love that the show asked the question. And also, I feel like, you know, we were sort of hoping this would be here and there were elements of it surrounding it, but this is also a spy show now.
Yeah.
You know, like it's just all our favorite genres mashed into one. And the whole execution of that scene is, it's Le Carre, right? Like it's, yeah, it's Checkpoint Charlie. It's just, it's thrilling. And when we, you know, Lonnie's a character that we have been seeing since the season premiered. I wish I had the actor's name in front of me. I will remedy that next week, but he is a phenomenal face. You know, like they've cast these rooms of people just as they ought to have. And so that you remember them, you see them in the background, you don't know what they're capable of or who they are. And in that moment, we just, we understand the stakes and we're feeling for, and it's performance again, great performances, but we understand the stakes of something that we weren't even aware of just moments before. And I think I want to bring up one other thing before we get to our interview with Tony, which didn't come up, but.
Oh no, we're power ranking all of our 1975 songs before we get to Tony, just so you know.
Oh, good. And can all of them be from Being Funny in a Foreign Language? Because yeah. To your point, I really like the new one. And, you know, we'll work our way backwards from there. Happiness number one, Wintering number two. Obviously, we adore the show and we adore it for what it is and also for what it represents and for what it's doing. And something bubbled up last week that I don't know if this is serious enough that it crossed any of our listeners' transoms, but people are like, oh, is Clea... Luthen's assistant, is she Leia? Because her name is Clea, and that's Leia with a K. And she
sort
has
of
a
an extension
haircut,
of like where you go like, when you start thinking about are they building the Death Star on that prison? Like, you know, what are the connective tissues to the larger Star Wars universe beyond like Clone Wars stuff?
And I just want to say, like, I think this show is a corrective to that thinking. Now, maybe it's more of a vaccine, so it doesn't prevent full infection, but it definitely blunts the effects of it. Like, if it's fun for you to watch this show that we're describing and be like, oh, is that Admiral Akbar's grandpa? Oh, in the aquarium? Is that who that is? So this means something more? Like, okay, that's fine. Like, that's one way to engage with culture. And we're not here to tell you you're doing it wrong. Although, if you are doing that with fish tanks, you might be doing it wrong. It's that it doesn't matter. This is what this show is. Look what it's doing. Look what it's doing as an entertainment on its own. You know what I mean? And I feel like if you're chasing those questions, I just kind of feel bad because you're missing the point. It's an important bulwark to establish that like something Star Wars could just be good, you know? And I would say this about other IP when we cover and if we have the opportunity to say that, you know, it might be an interesting test case in a way to think about that question when Wakanda Forever comes out in a week because, you know, I'm just avoiding, I don't want to read anything about it. I just want to see the movie. Yeah. But I did see one headline that was basically like the original drafts of the movie when Chadwick Boseman was going to be able, when he was alive and able to participate in it, was more connected to the blip and the
like
snap
that.
And everything. And obviously they had to change all that. And, you know, there's a glimmer of hope in that for me. Because I think it would be good for the movie and for the franchise and for Ryan Coogler and for the cast and for Marvel, frankly, to have something that was just good. Please. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's a testament to the fact that maybe the more, I wouldn't say it's been described as scattershot or haphazard or whatever, but the way in which Star Wars has sort of been assembled over the last few years where it's like, we're trying to figure out what works and oh my gosh, like Baby Yoda, like we got to do more stuff like this. And, you know, maybe you get a little bit of freedom on the margins if you're not like, well, we got to start building towards Kang though. You know, like we got it. Everything ultimately has to go towards this main thing. And it'll be interesting to see how like James Gunn and Peter Safran handle DC. You know, I have less time for the DC characters, but just as a thought experiment, like, do you start from zero? Do you work with people you already have? Do you have multiple storylines that seem incongruous with one another going at the same time? Like what's the approach there? And what have ultimately, since these are things are all consumer driven anyway, what do people show up for? Should we get into our interview with Tony?
Yeah, I mean, and just to say, you know, it's such an honor and such a pleasure to speak to someone who we
like
so much and admire so
moment.
Much.
Yeah.
I think he talks about it better than we can, but sort of sets the scene as to where we are now, both in the season and in the project, the series as a whole. We spoke to him last week from his home in New York, where he was about to fly to London to begin prep on season two, which is going to be an additional 12 episodes. So there are two episodes left this season. Mm-hmm. Right. And God, it feels, I mean, I'm glad. I'm so glad they're weekly.
Yeah.
I would like
it's an old school television experience now where I feel like I can't wait for them to come. I can't wait to talk about them with people. I can't wait to listen to like Midnight Boys and House of R and think about it and like to hear what other people see in it, what other people feel about it. It's just an awesome, this is why I like TV, is like it becomes this 2 month, you know, community kind of viewing experience.
Yep.
That's why I'm on the boards. That's why I'm in the forums. We are produced as always by Kaya McMullen. Andy and I will be back on Monday to talk about.
Chris, are you still on Television Without Pity, but you're doing like the Travolta and Pulp Fiction meme? Just looking for everybody?
Yeah. Where'd you guys go? Twitter? We're produced by Kaya. That's Andy. I'm Chris. Here's Tony Gilroy.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
We are so excited to have Tony Gilroy back on The Watch to discuss screenwriting, spycraft, the Star Wars prison industrial system, and all things Andor up through episode 10. Tony, thank you so much for coming back on.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. You guys have been killing it.
You're the one that's been killing it, Tony. Yeah. We're, as you know, as you've heard, we love your show. We love the show. We feel lucky to be watching it week to week and having so much fun with it. And, you know, when we last spoke a couple of weeks ago, we had seen, I believe, 4, and now we've seen 10. And one of the things we took away from our conversation with you was that you were biting your tongue. There were things still to come that we hadn't seen, that you seemed eager to talk about or eager for us to see or eager to fold into our understanding of the show. And now that we're a little bit further down the road, we haven't seen it all yet, of course, but I wanted to ask you, what specifically was in your mind when we spoke? Was it specific set pieces, the way the show was be changing every 3 episodes, just the scope of what you had in store? What were you thinking about that you couldn't talk about during the first round of press?
I think it was the abundance, you know, just it was hard to describe to people in the beginning how far we were going to go and how deep we were going to go and what a mad buffet of insane depth we were going to take this thing to, and how, you know, just the abundance of it was hard in the beginning. That's why we released those first 4, because you're like, oh my God, if people just think it's just going to be in Ferrix and just in Canary and we give them 4 and then they'll see that it's going to get bigger. But you see now how ambitious everybody's been, and we still have a little bit of ways to go. So I think it was mostly about the scale.
But you also heard us, I think, say a couple times, like, we were so excited to be thinking of those first few episodes as sort of a launch point for Cassian and like where he was going to go and what was going to define him. So that we were almost surprised that we go back to Ferrix. Surprised in a great way, because we weren't done with those characters. We were happy to see them again, happy to see them fold in on itself. Wow. Dedrus goes there. So that was clearly always part of the plan, that it wasn't just going to move in one direction outward. It was going to just continue.
No, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out that we're going back again. I mean, I think everybody would know. You could tell that we have a lot of stories still to tell there. So yeah.
You also have Fiona Shaw there, so you got to go back.
We have Adria. Adria's still there. Exactly.
She's great.
Tony, I wanted to ask a little bit about 10, because that was obviously like probably the most thrilling episode, both in terms of the prison break set piece, but in terms of Stellan's performance at the end of the episode, which I thought was just phenomenal and you know, kind of gave me a peek into the George Smiley character that he is playing and his understanding of his sort of larger responsibility. Can you tell me a little bit about conceptualizing the prison? Because obviously it's a factory as well as being someplace where people are incarcerated, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like that before. And the idea of creating this workplace that's also a prison, I know that jails do produce license plates and all sorts of stuff here, but can you walk us through a little bit about what you saw in your head and how it manifested itself?
It was one of the blanks in the, you know, when we came to the writer's room, we did this like 5-6 day writer's room with Bo Willimon and my brother Danny. And then also, I don't know if we talked about it or not, but Luke Hall, our production designer, was in every one of the meetings, and Zana Wallenberg, our producer, in all those meetings. So the show is being built in, you know, the table's there, they're sitting in one row back. They're watching the whole thing being built. So there was some, I think I'd written 1, 2, and 3 ostensibly and had a lot, you know, I knew where we were going to end up. I knew what 11 and 12 were going to be, but there were some gaps in the middle. And one of them was prison. And like you put prison down on the table between Bo and Danny and I, and you know, I mean, what's the first thing? The first thing is, well, we've been gorging on great prison material for a century of American cinema. I mean, it's just, there's no shortage of great prison movies. So it's like, well, if we're going to do this, the very first thing is, if we can't disrupt it and we can't do something new, then we're not going to do it. So what could we possibly ever do? Forget if it's even germane, or forget if it's even, first things first, what's the prison we never saw before? And I really, honestly, God, in the last 4 days, I've been trying to figure out, I don't think we'll ever know who said electric floors, because the conversation in that room was just such a blur of imagination and antagonism. and whoever said electric floors, the moment that came out, and, you know, all of a sudden we're off to the races. And like, so the construction of the prison and the methodology of the prison and the way it worked predated its elemental, you know, when you're writing well, when you're getting lucky, when you're writing well, all the things that you do mechanically, the little breadcrumbs that you leave, all of a sudden you look back later on, you go like, oh my God, that actually is thematic. That actually fits with this. That actually it did. But I have to be honest, the primary motivation was to do something different first.
As you're talking about this, I'm picturing Andy Serkis's performance in this. And, you know, one of the things that we adore about the show and about your writing generally is there are no small characters, there are no small parts, and you've just been so blessed in this series with such incredible actors that I've never seen before that now I will watch whatever they do.
Right.
Andy Serkis is a recognizable face and name, and he comes to this for this arc. And I'm curious about the conception of the character and then also the conversation with him about what he's going to bring to this part, where he's going. Because as he is, when he's introduced and he's playing a certain role, he's the foreman, he's sort of the, you know, he's the company man basically on the floor, his transformation, his arc, building to his speech in this episode, and then building to something that I don't want to gloss over, which is the last time we see him, which is that he can't swim, which is, you know, again, it's just this cherry on top of the sundae of this episode. Anyway, there was a question in there that was basically
is the question about the process to get there? I mean, I guess that's a simple, I guess that's a way to walk it in. I mean, look, so you got a prison, okay. And we've determined, oh, we're going to have they're going to make something there and the floors are electrified. And oh my God, that's fantastic. And we're always concerned about the economics of the empire. And like, where do they get all their shit? Who built Scarif? Who built Edu? Yeah. You know, it's the thing in Clerks where he's like worrying about what the janitors are doing in the desk, right? And it's like, for real, man, where does all this shit come from? And like, okay, well, that's cool. Well, God, if you have a prison, you got to have a shot caller. And we need a shot caller. We need an explainer, right? Okay, let's do that. So we got this guy. So he's a charismatic guy. So that's the first thing you have. And then as you start to build it out, this idea was not immediately present, but certainly by the time we get deep into the rewrites and it becomes clear to me, you know, what I love about the prison and Andy is that, you know, for Cassian, this is a survival political experiment. The prison is a microcosm of the empire, and it really is a place where he becomes a leader and does all these weird, you know, interesting, exhibits all these, you know, sort of nascent leadership skills. But for me, what's so potent about it, and what we told Andy before he did it, really, it's about faith. It's really a religious thing for me in a sense. I mean, Andy is, his afterlife is freedom, right? And yeah, he has to believe in that. And it's what do you do when you're, you know, it's my version of what do you do when your faith is taken away? You know, it's really a religious thing for him. It's not a political, I don't see him as a cog in the empire. I don't see him as a proto-fascist or anything else. I just see him as somebody who believes if I do the right thing, I will have this afterlife, and finds out that they're not going to get that.
You touched on Cassian's sort of political awakening that happens in prison, and prisons are, you know, in throughout fiction and memoir and film and TV are known as these places of spiritual and political transformation.
Right.
What do you think is the difference between the Cassian that goes into that facility and the one that comes out?
Leadership. I mean, he's been standing aside. What did he do before? He said, oh, you're left-handed, you should be on this side. Or I know how to fly the Rono trawler. Don't do that. Or like, I killed the guy who was going to rip you off. He's always staying, you know, there's a joke, I'm only staying 6 more weeks. He's only like, he's always an outsider. You can't be an outsider anymore. He's in it. He's in another world. He'll die there. And the only way out, as he realizes, the only way out is to, in some way, make a rebellion, right? He has to do the thing in a microcosm that all these other people have been talking about. And, you know, Alex Lawther's talking about it theoretically. And, well, it's very immediate for him. And a really amazing leadership moment where it's not just taking charge, but it's realizing the tools that you have. And to nominate Andy, to nominate Kino as the voice who could motivate people to move forward, to realize it's not you, but the better tool is this other person. Mm-hmm. That's a real Spartacus moment, man. That's a really big thing. That's leadership 2.0. And the guy that gets out of that prison is a different dude than went in.
One thing that we know about you as a writer and as a professional is that you're serving the story first. But I have to ask, you know, the glee that you displayed when we spoke last time about the show, and you've made reference to us in other interviews about how, you know, you had accepted that as a professional film writer, whatever high percentage, 80% of your work is never going to get seen. How much of that affects the decisions you're making with a show where suddenly you have this canvas and you can say, well, I've always wanted to do a prison story. I've always wanted to do a heist movie. I've always wanted to do Cold War spycraft. You know, and now you have the canvas to do those stories.
No. I never say, oh, I have an agenda, I want to get to that, unless it doesn't feel, no, I don't go. I mean, there's so many, I mean, all the opportunities just present themselves anyway. So why should I worry about any of that? No, I'm trying to follow the, I'm trying to follow the trail. I'm trying to pull the string all the time. If you don't pull the string, then we lose our way. Cause it's, I mean, look, I mean, anybody who's, if you're, and you guys are deeply appreciating the show, and I'm assuming people that listen to you, you know, I mean, this is more than anything else. This is an exercise in plotting. I mean, we have to plot. The plot is every single step of the way, every single thread, every buttonhole has to be done. Everything has to be proper. It has to be right. And it's just that comes first. So I wouldn't want to say, oh, gee, I got to do I got to do this. I got to, you know, I don't even know what the scene would be. I don't have a farming scene, so I got to do the farm. You know, I mean, it's not like that.
Let's talk about the plotting. Let me ask you about the plotting piece, because plotting and structure and getting things buttoned up and tight, you know, within the 120 pages that you have is your job. You know, it's a huge part of the job that you've had for many years and excelled at. Traditionally, you know, in a TV writer's room, like that's where that gets done. You know, you get the 8 or 9 disparate voices and you're like, well, what about this? Maybe that. I have a sense of where this could go. You mentioned having the room and having prison written on the board with your brother and with Bo. When you walked into that room, how much of the plotting was already determined by the work you'd done alone and how much was open for debate in that room in a more traditional TV sense?
I don't really, I mean, I dropped, 100 pages of stuff on the table. I don't know. I had the beginning, I had the end, I had the, you know, I have, I think I had a lot of the idea for the basic idea for Aldani. I knew he was going to go to prison. I knew we were going to end up. I mean, I don't know percentage wise, it's impossible to say, but then it goes beyond, then it goes after that because then things shift in transit and, you know, and Bo and Danny, and then the second time around, we added Tom Bissell just this last time for this last go around. These sessions are incredibly exciting and they're just ridiculously fast paced and aggressive and mean and not for the faint of heart, but they're incredibly productive and everybody there really knows how to do that. But that gets you to point B. And then, you know, everybody goes back and writes their scripts and it gets you to C, D, and E, but then you still have the whole alphabet as you go through production and those guys aren't around and things change and you can't afford them. You know, they don't want to be bothered anymore. So then you have, you know, then you have a lot of the nitpicky stuff has to just be done afterwards. A lot of, you know, follow up conversations and check my work and do this. But, it's just, I don't know. I've developed it's not Socratic, I guess, but I actually dialogue with myself most of the time. It's just what I learned, I don't know, 20 years ago or whatever, you just can't let anything go. If you think it's a problem, you got to deal with it. It's right. Just like anything else. It's like a health issue. It's like, if you have a health issue here, it's an infection. If you don't put something on it, so you have to deal with everything. And anytime you skip a step, you get boned, you get screwed. It's just guaranteed.
Was there any character or thread here that was particularly malignant?
Yeah.
Like that you think back on as like, well, that's the one I keep having to return to and attend to.
You know, sometimes the things happen and I don't want to say this because I don't want people to jam me with problems, but a lot of times the limitations are really turned out to be advantages. What's an example? Like Aldani was originally written to have like 6,000-7,000 people show up for the festival. You know, it was really going to be the Aldani Festival. We're going to really do it. And that's the way it was written. That's the way we did it in the room. And that's the way we blocked it. And it made everything, the mechanics of the heist and everything much different. But COVID couldn't do it. Can't shoot. Can't get that many people. Can't really tile that many people into a thing. It doesn't really work. And it's like, oh my God, well, so there's a budgetary social, there's a reason why we can't do it. So what do we do? So, oh, okay. So well, what if it's dead enders? What if it's the end of this thing? What if it's the, you know, Lakota Sioux on the last reservation? What if it's just, wow, that's really even better. That's actually fascinating. And so all of a sudden that becomes its new reality and you build a new reality and you have to build a whole new blocking system around that. But that's an example of something that was a persistent rub. I think juggling the time frame of the prison, I think when we left the prison in the writer's room and even late into the writing process, it was way too shaggy and we weren't really, how long is he really in there? And finding a way to tighten up the prison was a real bugaboo. And, you know, coming up with the idea of, oh my God, new man coming down. If we don't do it tomorrow, getting to the idea, if we don't do it tomorrow, we're never going to have another chance. And that's a late discovery and that changes a lot of things and it really helps stuff out. But that was a real bugaboo along. But that's our inside baseball screenwriting kind of.
That's also what we live for, is to hear stuff like that. I think that the character that I've become more or less obsessed with is Luthen. And this episode was very much a Luthen showcase towards the end of it, along with the huge set piece in the prison. I was curious. He's obviously a spy master. He talks in his conversation with Lonnie about life being a performance and never being able, you know, having to be these different people. He is different people. He's different with Cassian as he is with Vel, as he is in his shop, as he is with Mon. He's different with Lonnie. And I was wondering whether, obviously, Stellan is playing that part with those wrinkles, with those different sort of variations on a theme in those different interactions. How do you write for someone who's performing in their own life like that?
Oh, he makes so much sense to me. I don't know. I just really understand. He's a founder. You know, he's, if you think of it, he's a guy who's made a startup company, you know, a really hot startup. And how do you scale up? What do you do? How do you scale up? And how do you scale up when secrecy, I mean, he's confronting, you know, he panics with Clea earlier on, like, oh my God, we're going to go loud tomorrow. And what's going to happen? And like, we've been doing this. We've been, you know, I've been building this thing in my garage for the last 15 years. And we're going to take it out on the street tomorrow. Well, what happens? All of a sudden, the neighbors are going to know what we're doing. And it's that, the torment of the founder, the torment of the true believer. Everything that he says in that speech to Lonnie, I believe is true. I don't think he's gaming him at all. I think that's a really, I want that to be, and Stellan knows that, and we spent a lot of time on that. That is real. What he's saying there is a cri de coeur. I mean, he really, that's as naked as he's ever being. And I think that I think one of the things that we will definitely be playing as we move forward, you know, throughout the whole thing is how do you scale up? What happens to the original gangsters as everything gets normalized?
So he's even, you think he's being truthful when he says to Lonnie, I think about you constantly, because it's almost this act of seduction.
I think he does. I mean, there's a scene, well, it's coming up, but I mean, he's going to get overwhelmed by secrecy. How do you stay secret and go bigger and bigger and bigger? How do you stay alive? How does he keep his, we're trying to be very practical, and we're never trying to, we don't want to have any loose things like, oh, why doesn't somebody recognize him? Or why doesn't somebody know who he is? Or why doesn't somebody talk or whatever? I mean, we're being very, trying to be very rigorous about our espionage and our secrecy, the roles of that. So he's really facing a new kind of fear in our show.
But
very easy to build this for the last 10, 12 years. How he goes around to barracks and does all this stuff. He's always in secret. Well, now it's a different game, right?
Yeah. The line where he says, Clay is like, you know, it's a trap. And he's like, if it's a trap, we already lost. You know, if it doesn't matter anymore. We've now gotten into zero sum territory.
They have a lot of cliffs to jump off of along the way.
Over the course of even just these 10 episodes, you've created dozens of incredibly memorable characters. One character you didn't create is Mon Mothma, and Genevieve O'Reilly is a performer you inherited in the role. She had played it already. Her scenes have been some of the best in the series, just absolutely electric and riveting, even though sometimes she doesn't even leave the drawing room. Sometimes she doesn't even leave the couch, as in this amazing scene with the gangster. How do you approach a situation like this where you have an actor that's already cast in a role that is pre-existing, and how do you decide what's interesting to you and how to put her in the best positions to succeed?
When I went over there in the beginning, when I was going to direct 1, 2, and 3 and that sort of whole winter, fall, winter before COVID, and when in my naivete, I'm going to do my 3 and the other scripts are coming in and somehow this will all work out, whatever the hell I was thinking. I would absolutely numb to what was coming at me, you know. Well, okay, I have Genevieve and she plays Mon Mothma. She's supposed to be a pretty good actor and there's no choice there. We're going to hijack this thing. And I sat down and I met her and I knew her from Rogue. But it's the same thing with like Kyle and with Denise and with all these different actors, and particularly with Genevieve, you sort of go, oh my God, this is a Stradivarius. Holy cow. I can write anything for her. You start to write better. You start to write more ambitiously. I don't think I had any idea how good she was or what she could do. And I don't think I knew how far I was going to take her or what kind of scenes we were going to give her in the beginning. No, I think we rose. I think everybody rose into that. She's amazing.
She's amazing. I mean, this is the episode with the prison break, and I'm still thinking about her scene on a couch.
I know that was, yeah. And that was a Bo. I remember the night that Bo called me up because you're trying to figure out what's the Davos Golden and how's he going to get out of the problem. And when he called me up and said, oh my God, he goes, what about the sun? I'm like, oh my God, dude. So he goes, can we do that? And I go, I don't care what they say. We have to do that. So we went back and
Bo, have you seen House of the Dragon? You can do that.
Well, no, but it's, yeah, but we have a different, we don't
yeah,
we
I
have
know.
Different standards and practices than other people do. We don't have some of the tools that they have. And I would love to have some of the, some of the paints that they have in the Thrones, but we don't have. So, but it's like, yeah. And then, Yeah, I love the scene with Davos Goldman. I love it.
Staying on the theme of performance for a moment, one thing that really struck me, especially over the last three episodes, is just the physical nature of Diego's performance. You know, and when we talk about you, Tony, and your writing and the things that we love, there's a certain verbal dexterity and a conversational flow and the way that the words come out and the speed and velocity, et cetera. To have your lead actor be so willing to not be the driver of that, you know, just the decision making. And as we're speaking, this is a podcast, but Tony is on program right now with his hands, and which I appreciate. But I actually was going to ask about that.
On program. Oh my God.
Well, exactly. But only because you notice during these episodes that Cassian goes on program differently than other people. You know, like this is it feels like there are decisions made about what he does with his body versus other people. And that's a different type of writing and a different type of lead performance.
Yeah, but it's, I think any writer who's had the benefit, I mean, the drag for a lot of young writers is you don't get to see a lot of your stuff done and you don't get to see a lot of actors and you don't suffer through your own indulgences and all your own bullshit. You just think everything is fantastic. And, you know, it used to be, I mean, people were playwrights and whatever. Now people are, you know, if you're in film school or if you're an unproduced screenwriter, you just don't know how much the camera can do and how much the actors can do. There's nothing like sitting, I think, on Dolores Claiborne. I've told this story before. On Dolores Claiborne, we had dailies it was like a Robert Altman situation. We had dailies every night for the whole company in this movie theater in Nova Scotia. And, you know, Taylor Hackford likes to shoot a lot of coverage. So the dailies are long and I was writing on it and I was, you know, and all these great actors and I was being encouraged to write all the time. And I just sat there in dailies every night, just mortified at my verbosity and why did I write this and get rid of that? And, oh my God, I can't believe we're seeing this again. And just so bored with myself and mean. And like, that's one level of education. Then you go and direct a movie and you're like, oh my God, the camera can do everything. All I have to do is put a camera on George Clooney's face in the back of a taxi cab and I can, that's worth everything. And you learn those things along the way. And, I've never had a conversation ever with Diego where he says, I don't have enough lines or I'm not saying, I mean, this is a camera movie star. He holds the camera. He knows what to do. I never think about that. I don't know. I don't know if that's the answer to the question or not.
It is.
You know, I was reading an interview that Denise Gao gave where she was talking about the Dedra character. And in the same way that Cassian goes through some sort of kind of, and awakening transformation in prison, I feel like putting Dedra in the field, it's maybe not a transformation as much as it is you know, a mask off moment that she actually is this fascist that she seems like, but you know, in the early episodes it's much closer to, oh, you know, she's a woman in a man's world and this is tough for her too, and she's trying to figure out, she's trying to chart her path. And then you get her out there and you give her some torture headphones and things go a little bit sideways. What do you think changes at all? Or is it just the same person in a different context when Dedra gets out in the field?
Well, we had the parallel experience in the room because when we were writing her, we're like, okay, she's, you know, all the things you say, she's the underdog and there's only one other woman in the room and they're treating her like shit and she's doing a better job than anybody else and nobody's paying attention. And we're like rooting for her all the way through. And then we got to like Ferrix and we're like, oh my God, we were like, okay, well, that'll be cool. If we can make the audience feel the way that we feel, then that's super cool. So yeah, we shared that revelation in the room writing her.
Yeah. I imagine that, I mean, without getting too deep into the real world applications of sound torture, the headphones was just like that kind of like Oculus set that they put on Bix. I was like, I've seen a lot of torture in films. I don't think I've ever seen, let's have children screaming into this like one frequency. It's stunning.
That's the theater of the mind, right?
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of our love for the show and goes back to something you said before, or it's come up already twice in the conversation when, oh, someone said electric floor and then you're off to the races. Bo calls you in the middle of the night and says, what if he suggests their children get married? And that's kind of like thunderbolt moment when you've been chasing the best version, the new version, the unsurprising version, but then there's a clarity, right? When you know what it is. And I think that that's what, as an audience, you can feel that same electricity.
Yeah, you know. I mean, you know when there are things, and I've got things in the show and I've got things in movies and stuff that are worked at and they work, and you've pushed them through and you've detailed them enough and you've hidden what's wrong about it and you've covered up the rust and you put enough, you know, body putty on it to make it work and it passes muster. But hopefully those are as few and far between as you can possibly make, because what you're really looking for is that natural feeling of something that just drops and you just go, oh my God, that's natural. That's perfect pitch. Everything. And you know that, like, okay, there it is. Everything else that's going to go into making this work is just effort and taste. It's not going to be, I don't have to find it. There it is. And that's what you're trying to have a whole, you're trying to do everything that way. It's not always that way, but you're trying to get there.
I mean, one of my favorite things about the show is that not only do we get moments like that, but we have devoted time to Cyril eating cereal with his mother. Now, we are on your side. We love these scenes. But just for the sake of an exercise, if you were to pretend we were like villainous Sith Kathy Kennedy, she's not like this. But if we were, and we were like, what are we doing with these scenes? This is a show about a rebellion and we need more action. Can you just, for the purposes of the exercise, make the case why those scenes are so vital?
No.
Even better.
I have a follow-up question, though. How come I can't go 5 feet without seeing Baby Yoda plush toys everywhere, but I can't get Cyril's cereal in the stores yet?
There was a cereal that looked like that when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's like Cocoa Puffs or whatever. Right? Yeah.
I had no hand in that, in the cereal or the blue milk. When that showed up in Dailies, as a set, obviously, everything else. I mean, every inch of the set and what she's wearing and what he's wearing and what they're saying, all the rest of it. But no, the cereal and the blue milk and the stuff is a surprise to me. And it's really, everybody directed those scenes really well. Everybody got what that was about. And Catherine is just, I don't know, they're kind of my favorite thing, really.
So, when you were in pre-production in the room and then in production on this, I mean, the degree to which this is, how big a swing this was, I don't think was even, we didn't realize in terms of the scale and the scope and just for us as fans, what you have done creatively with this franchise and the direction you've put it in and the doors you've kicked in for it going forward. Now that you are about to embark on the back half of it with a company that has now seen the results that's been received, has there been any change in the conversation? Like, is there excitement? Is there a different level of confidence that Star Wars can do this? You know, because in a way, what's kind of amazing to us is that it was a leap of faith on everyone's part that, like, this is also Star Wars.
I mean, we have money issues, you know. I mean, money's an issue. So we, you know, there's things we'd like to do that are just too expensive, and, you know, there's all those issues. But no, not text-wise or tonally or anything. We don't have any instructions or anybody, you know, people watch what we do. They pay attention to what we do. They certainly pay attention to how we do it. We try to be as incredibly disciplined as possible. I mean, there's shows out there that have no budgets, you know, that are just like, you know, they're just, or shows that are, have come apart and come back together. We're super tucked away. We eat every single piece of the cow. We're using everything that we get, but, no, I haven't had any, nobody's come and said, don't do this.
I was curious whether or not anything about whether it's the reception to the show or watching people watch the show has influenced, not in a concrete way, obviously you can't reveal, has influenced the writing of the second season. Now, because it's a unique experience, I think, for you, where it's like, yeah, you didn't do part two of Michael Clayton after everybody started quoting Michael Clayton.
Right. That is an interesting question. I don't think so. It's been just fascinating to watch the conversations. I mean, it's just so new, and it's such an unusual experience. I don't know if you can even imagine. I mean, it's 6 weeks, and you know, I'm not on social media, but I'm a voyeur and I go on and I peek and I look at stuff. And why wouldn't I? I mean, anybody who says that they're, I mean, I'm trying not to do it obsessively. People flag stuff and they send it to me. But I mean, even people just having super arguments about the show is just fascinating to me. I love what they do. I think, trying to think if there's anything to be influenced. I think one legit thing we have not dealt with a lot of creatures and aliens and things like that on the show. I think there will be some coming up, and we are all through. We have a pretty organic approach to it, and we certainly want to be in the Star Wars universe. I think we've been a little shy on some of that. I think that's a legit thing that has entered my mind a little bit as we've gone forward, but not really. No, it's fascinating to watch all these people try to, you know, not appropriate, but try to adopt the politics of the show for their particular politics. Because we're not trying to be contemporary in any sense. Anything that is contemporary is just the fact that people aren't looking at history. I mean, slavery, colonialism, imperialism, oppression, frustration, political, I mean, these are 3,000 year old issues. You just go back through every single piece of history and you can just drop the needle anywhere you want. And that's what we're kind of doing. That's the beauty of doing a show like this, is you can just cherry pick everything from, you know, in recorded history, a political history. It's all there. So it's interesting to watch people try to pin us down contemporarily. But no, I don't think I haven't changed anything really specifically that we're doing, other than just trying to keep our standards up and not get lazy.
So Tony, thank you again for this time. We have to let you go, but I know that two episodes left in this season. You're about to go to London. You got 12 more. I think I know your answer to this, but I'm going to ask anyway. Anything you'd like to tell us and the listeners about the next 2 weeks?
Yeah, what are they making in the jail?
anything you'd like to prepare
us
for?
The writer's room. The jail is the writer's room. They're building the second season in the writer's
room. That's right.
That's what they're doing. That's right.
Bo Williman hasn't worn shoes in 3 years.
I'm trying not to get fried. I want to get flavor tonight. That's my goal.
Yeah.
I would only say this, that if people dug along the way, I mean, we're in control of our story, you know, we're in control of it. And I saw some people say, oh, it looks like people aren't really, you know, it's chaotic. All these characters are going on. There will be convergence. We will round out. We have some place that we're going to. I think it'll be a satisfying place to finish and a pregnant moment to continue. That's the plan. So,
well, we wish you nothing but good luck, continued success off in London season 2. Please know that as a reward.
I want you guys to stop watching any other shows now. I just think
we have.
Stop, man.
You've ruined us. We have. Well, I mean, have you noticed? We're talking about like deadline news headlines.
It's really always a pleasure, and perhaps we will do a final wrap up if we arrange all that.
So, that would be really great. Thank you so much for coming back.
Chris and I are going to stay in the Zoom just for the next couple weeks.
Yeah, we'll just be here. You drop in whenever you can.
We're ready.
I'm going on program.
You are. So are we.
Take care, Tony. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank
by.
You. Bye bye.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.